Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why episode 288, on which I had the pleasure of speaking with composer and music director Ammon Taylor. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. I'm going to be honest, you guys. Everyone I know uses Audible. I continue to do this ad because I figure there's got to be somebody who's listening who's like a holdout, who's like, I'm not going to do that. Like, that's not something I need. But we all need to read to improve our minds and to improve our lives, or just to do some research on something we're writing or find out more about that cool celeb we like so much. And, you know, Audible has somebody reading it to you. You don't even have to read the book. You just listen to Audible, and somebody else, often a celebrity who you like, reads you this book. It's really amazing, and you got to get into it. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to sign up and get your account today. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by podcastcadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is the company my husband Chris and I run to help podcasters. Let us help you get connected with the people that you need to improve your podcast. Sometimes people ask us to edit their podcast or help them with their podcast website. They ask us for advice on how to distribute podcasts. Sometimes people are looking for a marketing director, and we connect them to the people that we know in the industry. That's what we're here for. We're here to help podcasters. So let us help you. And mention code YBY20 to get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. We can help. PodcastCadet.com. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is my resource for vegan-friendly whole plant extract CBD oil. Check out TrueHempScience.com to see all the CBD products available to you now. There's so many different kinds of things, and you might just find that it helps you to calm down, or maybe it just helps, you know, your skin to feel a little bit better, or just sort of calms down some of your allergies. I've heard a lot of different things from a lot of different people, so check it out and see how CBD can help you. Use code YESBUTWHY7 to get 7% off your order of $50 or more. Plus, you'll get that free packet of 2 CBD edibles with your order. TrueHempScience.com. This week on Yes But Why, I connected with the Paramount Theater's education music director, Ammon Taylor. In our conversation, Ammon talks about how music has been part of his life since he was born. We chat about deep feelings, jazz trios, and wanting to save the world. I now present to you Yes But Why episode 288, Ammon Taylor on Saving the World One Musical at a Time. Enjoy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah. When you were a little kid, what were the things that you were doing to play? What were the ways in which you had fun?
Well, I like to play outside, you know. We had probably a quarter acre lot on our house. We weren't quite rural, but we had a big backyard. I would love to, you know, go out there and climb trees and things. I also loved music a lot.
Yeah, already early on.
Early on, I liked music a lot, and I enjoyed listening to it. You know, I had a cassette player. I had some favorite cassettes. I started playing piano pretty early. I don't know if I would count that as play. Though I enjoyed practicing, I don't think that was... part of that world of playing. But yeah, I enjoyed playing outside. I enjoyed, imagining, however, whatever you want to call it, playing pretend with a couple of friends that I had in the neighborhood. Mm.
Any siblings?
Yes, I have 4 siblings, and they're all much older than me.
Huh.
So I feel like I sort of grew up in a house of adults.
Oh.
Which was nice. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, all right. So they were all older, so you probably were playing by yourself, not with the siblings, because they're like teens when you're 6 and 7, that kind of thing?
Yes, exactly.
Right on. Right on. Yeah. They were like, no, we're not going out in the backyard, Emin. I'm on the phone. Leave me alone. Yeah. All right. Interesting. So it's not like you're like playing pretend with them. You had to like figure it out on your own. Interesting mm-hmm. too, because, you know, after parents have a couple of kids, they have this vibe, and I noticed this with my friends that have a couple of kids, this vibe where like the younger ones are like, they're all right. And I'm like, all right, cool. Where is he right now? You don't know? Okay, cool. Hope that works out. But it does. Like, and there's this weird mm-hmm. sort of like, you know, because there's these sort of like, it's almost like your little at-home village. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, mm-hmm. not everyone's really watching, but, you know, one of the older brothers or sisters can be all like, yeah, I'll walk down the street and tell him to come home. You know, and it's not crazy. And the other thing, too, is having other older siblings. I felt like this for myself. I'm the older sibling. And I have a younger sister. Mm-hmm. I felt like I provided at least the specter of, protection. Like, it'd be like, you know what I mean? Like, she'd be like, you better not mess with me. My sister will be there. And I'd be like, what? But I was you. My name was used as if, like, you better watch out. She'll take care of you. And I was just like, what? She's like, we're going to fight. I was like, cool.
Yeah, I did. I had a good relationship with my older siblings. You know, I had one older sister who we were close. She definitely had that sort of protective bond with me, would enjoy spending time with me. I remember, you know, she went through her Mariah Carey phase and her Celine Dion phase, and I went through those phases with her.
Awesome. Awesome.
But yeah, it was in that respect, with those the dynamics of being of having a lot of siblings but having them be much older, you know, my parents were much older as well. I remember it being something that I enjoy. I don't know if I want to say I enjoyed it, but it worked out well for me. I felt independent.
Yeah.
I felt, the things that I had interest in were readily available to me. So
yeah,
I enjoyed it.
And did they get you involved in piano because that was what they got everyone involved in? Like, it was like, okay, our kids are going to learn how to speak Japanese and play piano so they can go to Harvard. Was that the plan?
Well, minus the Japanese in Harvard, perhaps.
All right, just mine then. Okay.
But yeah, yeah. My mom is a music teacher.
Oh, great!
So she taught piano, she taught violin, she taught choir in high school, off and on. My mother's side of the family were all music teachers.
Oh, awesome.
That sounds like hyperbole. It's not. They're literally all music teachers. So on my mother's side of the family, it's just so strong that it was, it was simply a part of life, you know, that we were, all of us were expected to take piano lessons or study voice or something of that nature. It also dovetailed very nicely with, small town Utah Mormon culture, which definitely, you know, fosters the arts in that respect. So it wasn't, it was just a natural thing
Yeah.
that I did.
No, that's great that your mom was involved in it. One of the things that people, you know, I'm always talking to people like, how did the idea of being a creative ever occur to you? But I love this idea that it was like a whole section of your family. And it was just like, hey, this is a legit career. Look, it's employing half of our family. Like, yeah. This is an important, good thing and highly respected. You know, there's a lot of people out there that are like, that just don't have that, you know, their parents are like, you should be a lawyer. It's important, you know, and then, you know, they're like, I am interested in creative things. No, thank you. So it's wonderful that you had all this sort of like examples in front of you of different styles of music teachers from all of your different relatives. And then like, you know, it was an accepted and great part of what was going on. Super great. Were your other siblings like also as involved in music or like I'm sure they took it, but did they like embrace it the way you have or?
No, that is a good question. No one has pursued it professionally. Well, I have one brother who I would say did for a while, to varying degrees, you know, whether they studied it in college or, you know, sang semi-professionally as adults. They've all kept up with it in some regard. I think that for most of them, it's simply something that enriches their life, you know? And that's something, there wasn't any pressure to pursue this as a career or become professionally successful.
Right.
I do think a lot of it is part of the culture that I was raised in that, you know, music is a part of the community that we were living in. It was a part of, you know, the religious community and, you know, the services that went along with that and the pastimes that went along with that. So it's not an uncommon thing, you know, to have musical families. And I don't think that we were uncommon in that regard.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the only one that that had this deeper interest in it that I think people realized pretty early on was different. It was more extreme. It was more intense. And they were like, oh, okay, Amma needs to figure this out.
You know? What was extreme about it? Like, were you just like, I need a piano in my room. Like, this is what's going on. I will be in charge of these things. Like, in what way was your family like, whoa, hey, all right, I guess he's the guy in charge of music now.
Well, we had, you know, speaking of, you know, cassettes, I remember we had this box set of all of Beethoven's symphonies. Mm-hmm. And I loved it and I would listen to them constantly. And it got to the point where I had every theme of every movement of every symphony memorized and I could like play it on the piano. There was a hot minute, I think in fourth grade where like kids were calling me Beethoven on the playground
fourth
and everything.
Grade? Wow.
It was very, it was pretty apparent that I was a different kind of kid.
were you just like able to like hear it and put it out there? Or did it take you a while? Were you like listening to each one and you were kind of like finger picking it? I know that's not the word, but you know what I mean? Like you were, was it like you could hear it and you're like, oh, okay, I got it. Or was it like you spent a lot of time with each one to try to memorize them?
Oh, that's a good question. It's hard for me to remember what the process was like when I was that young.
Oh, yeah.
It certainly wasn't instant, you know. I've always had a good ear. So, you know, that ability to hear music and replicate it, you know, on the piano, that's always been a strong suit of mine. I would assume that, you know, it took me a while. I don't think that I was, I don't think that I was a savant level of, you know, ability when I was 8 years old. But
I mean, I don't know. You just told me that you like knew how to play all of Beethoven's symphonies in fourth grade. So like, really?
The themes, the main themes sure. of each symphony. I did not play the entire like 45 minute symphonies on the piano by ear.
Well, all right. Phenom-esque. Okay. But yeah, you know.
Sure. yeah, it was something that I consider it a very influential part of my experience. My life experience was that there's, you know, there's a lot of music there. You know, nine symphonies is a lot. I would listen to them constantly, and you know, there was a dialogue between them and like me playing on the piano. I even if it's hard for me to remember the specific details of how that happened, that was there. And that was a pretty, it was just a very seminal influence in my musical career, I think.
Yeah.
Musical life.
And certainly opened the eyes of your music teacher mom, who was like, oh, what's that? You want to play me a song, honey? Sure, that sounds great. And then you like whip out some Beethoven and she's like, oh my God. Like, how impressed was she? Was she like carting you around to all her friends' houses being like, do it, do it?
I think so. You know, again, part of the culture of, you know, being Mormon in Utah, everybody knows about everybody, sort of. So I think that there was this larger awareness in, you know, my church community that this was something that Ammon was going to do. There was, I remember my dad actually just called the local paper and was like, I've got a son who's real talented. You should do an article about him. And for whatever
Dad.
Reason, they were like, okay. So they did, publish a little piece about me. I remember the headline was A Young Beethoven in Providence. Providence, Utah was my little town, you know, and they took a little picture of me. My little arms were folded up and like the piano was open and I was resting on them with my little glasses. It was very adorable.
Oh my God, that's adorable. I can't wait to Google and find it. Oh my gosh. Oh, I love it. That is so wonderful. And go dad, like what a sweetie to be like, this kid's so good. I'm going to get him in the newspaper. I love it. I love it. That's so fun. Oh my goodness. So you're the most popular piano player in the whole town. They're writing articles about you. Everyone's like, listen to that. They're like hanging out outside your window, listening to you play, going like, this guy's got it. How did that continue to develop? You, as you mentioned a bit ago, you said like, everybody knew I was a little different. Were you a little different because you were like super into music and like really attached to it? Or was it like everybody else was kind of like, yeah, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to work at the grocery store. And you were like, I'm going to be Beethoven. Like what was the path for you through this community?
Well, yes. I mean, when I was younger, you know, me being like, I'm going to be Beethoven is cute, you know?
It's
and
adorable.
I think that it was, yeah, I think that that was sort of, how people saw me. When I was older, you know, well, I became different in many ways, you know, one of which I realized that I'm gay, which was a very big bombshell.
Sure.
You know, in Utah in the 80s or 90s, whenever it was, I guess early 90s. I also realized that I had major reservations about this religion, that everybody that I knew was a part of. So things changed quite a bit when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
It was a very rough time.
Yeah.
So my childhood was, in retrospect, so it feels like this very isolated period of my life, you know. Especially in regards to music and my musical ambitions, right? Where I thought, you know, as a kid, you have no concept of the way career paths and education and, you know, job prospects work. I was just like, I'm going to grow up and I'm going to be a composer and I'm going to write symphonies, you know?
Some people do. I mean, you just don't know.
Some people do.
Yeah,
you know?
I know. You were literally playing Beethoven. It doesn't sound that crazy.
It's true. You know, that morphed a lot when I was an adolescent. I was, like most kids, was very fond of the music that was in vogue at the time, which to me was a lot of, you know, Tori Amos and Alanis Morissette. And, you know, Sarah McLachlan, and everything Lilith Fair, you know,
that you're naming my tape set, my whole, yes. All my cassette tapes. You just read down the,
Yeah. So, you know, that was a shift for me. And I thought, you know, well, I want to be a confessional singer songwriter and pour out my angst through that, you know?
Yeah.
So that was a big shift for me, in terms of, that movement, that transition from childhood to adolescence.
Now, did you stick with the piano throughout? I know that you're actively sitting in front of a piano. So like, yes, clearly you did. But like, you mentioned confessional singer songwriter. I immediately think like a guy with a guitar in a smoky bar, which they don't have anymore, but they don't have smoky bars. They don't have guys with guitars. But like, were you composing, you know, sad confessional things on the piano, or were you using different instruments? Were you going to open mics outside of your Mormon community because, you know, they kind of weren't so excited about your music anymore?
I briefly played cello growing up. I think my mom was just like, you need to study an orchestral instrument, you know, like with the talent and everything. With the talent and everything.
You've got all this talent. Let's see where it goes.
Yeah. I dropped cello after a while. I was pretty good at it, but it frustrated me that I couldn't, you can only play one note at a time. And sure. I just really like, you know, using all of my 10 fingers.
Right. You're like, this is limiting, mom. I appreciate that I could work at a symphony, but I'm pretty sure they have piano players in symphonies too. So
yeah. I never played guitar. I had friends who did, you know. I at different times in my adolescence, I had friends, I remember, who were guitarists and singers. And, you know, we would play together or form little like angsty duos and, you know, write music and play together. You know, I did have when I was older, like 15 or 16, I had a little duo, and the two of us played a show at the local pizza place. We also got another article written about us in that local newspaper. About our little band. We called ourselves Intrinsic. We were so angsty.
I love it. I love it. Good for you. An angsty duo called Intrinsic in the 90s. Classic.
Right. Exactly.
I love it. You're so on point. It's funny how like later, you know, in life you can, the beauty of looking back on your life is like that you can create a lovely story from it, you know? Mm-hmm. And also that part of me, that's kind of why I bring up childhood, because I think that there's a lot of meat to be, you know, sort of to be pulled from childhood that we don't think of when we're adults, because we spend so much time sort of like, when we get into our 20s, we spend so much time trying to become ourselves that we reject everything that happened in the past. I know I did. And like, only when I got older, like when I got in my mid-30s, I was all of a sudden like, no, it's all right. It's all one journey. It's not like that journey and this journey. Like, it's just the one. So like, it led you to be part of the experience. And I love that your experience also fits so perfectly with the like cultural, like 90s, like grunge angst thing. Like, I get you. Like, I was writing some angsty poetry at this point. In the mid 90s, I remember I listened to Alanis Morissette, Jagged Little Pill on my Walkman while we drove around to colleges to visit to decide where I was going to go to college. Like, so every time I hear it, it like literally reminds me of like driving to Ohio to like check out like Kenyon College and like different spots. My parents were like, yeah, let's go on a road trip. Oh my gosh. But yeah, like it's so funny how that time, now that it's further away, I think of the 90s and like, oh man, it was so representative. It was such a this, you know?
Yeah. It is interesting, you know, what you mentioned about looking at your childhood experiences through a new lens now that you're older, you know, and I definitely feel that I'm doing that. I rejected so much of how I grew up and where, you know, a lot of those difficult things came from. So to be completely honest, I attempted suicide multiple times. I was institutionalized. It was not an easy time at all.
Yeah.
So there definitely was a tendency when I was older to want to start completely over, you know, completely new, fresh start. And it's actually a very recent journey for me to come around to, you know, I'm aware that I'm a bit of an idiosyncratic person. I'm aware that, you know, when people start talking to me for the first time, you know, I'm not weird per se, but I have, you know, mannerisms that are not common to, you know, most of the population. And I've always been okay with that, but it's been a part of a larger process for me to realize lately that a lot of the things that I love and enjoy about myself are directly related to, you know, Mormon culture and identity and the way that I grew up. And even though there's a lot that I'm not okay with that comes along with that. There's a lot of baggage, but there's a lot of good things as well. Things that, you know, the way that we are baked when we're that young, in many respects, lasts forever. And we need to make peace with that, you know? So that's definitely been something that I've been working on lately, in therapy. And now it's on a podcast.
Yeah, I hear you. I totally understand what you mean about the way that you're, you know, you have to reconcile yourself with the things that went on and the things that your rejection of that became part of like who you are as an adult, right? There's so many of us. And I think about that even with my own child. I'm like, someday he's going to fully reject a part of what we're giving him right now. And I'm gonna need to be okay with whatever it is that he decides. Like, my husband and I are both performers. What if he's like, I'm never going on a stage? P.S. I've met my child. He's gonna be on a stage. But at the same time, like, you know, certain things where it's like, this is a part of my life that I'm never going to be part of because these people just hammered it hard too much. It was like, all right. Okay, too much for me. It's like, I grew up in Boston. I have a negative view of Boston in my head.
Yeah.
I don't love it. I don't like visiting. I don't like, most of my family's moved away from it now. So I'm like, I don't really have to visit too often. But like, when people bring it up sometimes, I'm even like, it's just not a good place. And it's not a empirically a bad place, but it mm-hmm. holds all this weight for me about my past, and it contains stuff that I want to let go, right? Yeah. And so, yeah, you have to move on from those things. Other thing I wanted to mention to you to give you a level of comfort here with me is that you said when people first meet me, I'm unusual and people are surprised. I found you very, very regular in the theater people world. Now, admittedly, I have soaked myself in theater people for most of my adult life. And so now I think we're normal and the rest of those crazies, like, I'm like, what are they even doing? I don't know. What do you mean you don't process your life by writing a weird story? Like, you're not like going to therapy and then immediately talking improv with somebody? I'm confused, right? You know what I mean? And to that end too, the audience of this podcast is all theater people. I mean, these are your people. The people listening are going to be like, oh yeah, that's definitely, I understand, that happened to me too. Like, mm-hmm. we are, and I find personally for me, that's the only way I can live is to just forget that the rest of them are around. I'm like, oh, you don't understand what an artistic life is? Like, all the stuff I was joking about earlier about, like, during the pandemic and people were like, arts aren't important. And I was like, all right, well, sorry sure for your sad life. Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and continue to enjoy my life no matter what, because I've always got a song and dance in my head at every minute. So, yeah. But, you know, it's hard. Especially everywhere in the world, there are teens that are feeling alone in whatever environment that they are in. And in fact, one of the major reasons why I do this podcast is to put out in the world the fact that we're out here, guys. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Are you in the middle of a small town in Montana and you're like, good Lord, I need to be singing and dancing on a stage? You can just get old enough. You can leave and come to anywhere in the world that you've heard somebody on this podcast talking. They've got a community. You can go hang with them, right?
Yes.
But it's not everywhere. You know what I mean? Like, and some people aren't just inventing it. You know, like, I tell this story all the time, but there was like a guy who I talked to, who I interviewed one time, and I was like, so tell me about the improv community in your area. And he's like, well, there isn't any. Me and my best friend went to the library and got the Keith Johnstone book, and then we started doing it in this basement, and that's pretty much what it is. And I was like, that's beautiful. That is beautiful, because he was a go-getter and he like found it and he did it and he created it for himself. But you know, that's like 2% of people who are able to just be like, what? The world doesn't have what I want? Well, I will invent it right now. You know, like the confidence and ability to get over the hump of everybody around you being like, I'm sorry, what? Theater? Oh, okay. but so to ask you a question about how you moved on from this, mm-hmm. how did you get out of it? You know, you mentioned having mm-hmm. these tough times, you know, you were in the hospital for a little while. Like, how did you move away from that? I feel like if I were your mom and you had troubles, I would sort of keep you close. So how did she, you know, what happened that they, you know, let you spread your wings and fly and move on and learn?
Oh, it was very clear, very apparent that I needed to fly the nest, you know?
Yeah.
When I graduated high school, like less than a week later, my car was loaded up and I drove to Seattle. I had a friend of the family, an in-law who lived in Seattle. I was able to stay with her. Find a job. It was back in those days, you could just sort of, you know, show up at a Rite Aid and ask to work as a cashier, and I did.
You can still do that. I just wanted to throw that out. You can walk into anywhere and be like, hi, do you have jobs available? I just wanted to be clear for anyone who was listening. Still an option.
Still an option.
Don't be afraid. If you go in and you're like, I like this Rite Aid, I want to work here, just ask. It's fine.
But yeah, it was a great experience. You know, I lived on Capitol Hill in Seattle. I definitely got the whole gay experience. I understood like the ins and outs of what the community is about. I did that for a couple of years. You know, I was still playing music. I recall playing in coffee shops and things. And to me, that was just newfangled and exciting.
Coffee shops in Seattle. You're playing music like exactly. In the 90s. This is like tip top.
I know. I eventually, after a couple of years, I felt the need to. It was a very specific time in my life. And I'm trying to remember the impetus of this.
You don't have to remember the why. You can just tell me the what.
I wanted to travel abroad and I wanted to volunteer. And I started looking at programs that could do that. I joined one, had a training and development center in a school and on a mountain in Massachusetts. And then I went and lived in Mozambique and worked at a teacher training college there for 6 months. I spent a month in Durban, South Africa, and then went to Denmark. This organization is Danish. I look back at that with a very skeptical lens now. You know, it was, I learned incredible things from that. Incredible things for myself. It broadened me. It broadened my horizons. I would hope that whatever I left was more good than harm. I will say that. I sincerely hope that.
Yeah.
I did that. It was, the whole process was a little over a year. I went back to Seattle for 6 months. People were saying reverse culture shock is the thing. And I thought that was a lie. And then I went there and realized that it was very much a thing.
Yeah.
I was experiencing a lot of it. And I just wanted to leave the country again. So I taught English in Sao Paulo, Brazil, for 6 months. They speak Portuguese in Mozambique as well as Brazil. That was also a great experience. I loved Brazil. I loved Brazilian culture. I loved Brazilian music. I'm not the first musician to become enamored with Brazilian musical techniques and traditions because it's incredible. It's incredible. I did that. Eventually, I went back to Utah. I moved to Salt Lake City. I decided it was time for me to actually go to school. I had spent enough years, you know, discovering myself and having adventures and whatnot.
You got to do it. I think it's important.
Yeah.
And you know what, coming from where you were at, which was kind of a tight community that didn't feel super comforting to you, the idea that you had to travel the world to kind of see different things before you could decide anything for yourself, I think that's absolutely what you got to do. But I'm glad. So you get back to Salt Lake City to go to school. At this point, how old are you? Like, this was like, or 3 years? Like, were you like 20, 21?
I was, no. I, you know, between just living in Seattle and traveling and whatnot, I want to say I was 26.
Oh, right on. Okay, good.
I believe,
Long time of travel.
No, I was 20. I'm sorry. It was 2006. So I would have been 24 or 25, I think. Oh my goodness, what is time?
Math is difficult, I understand. Yeah. I'm just now thinking, like, how old was I in 2006? But it's okay, No, that's all right. We'll just write 2006, doesn't matter how old you were. You went to college, huh?
So I went to college. it was fine, you know. I started off, I just wanted to do things as cheaply as possible. I could have residency in Utah and go to a community college and get my associates out of the way. It was a lovely time in my life. I spent a lot of time with poets. I was dating a slam poet. There was a community of, I'm hitting all the like angsty 90s lifestyle.
I'm in college in Salt Lake City, dating a slam poet. Ooh, all right.
But I remember, you know, having amazing parties and philosophical discussions with, you know, these poets and artists who are part of this counterculture, you know, in this, you know, repressive place. And it was wonderful.
Love it.
But when it came time for me to, I wanted to study composition. And when it came time for me to transfer, I had reservations about, you know, the University of Utah, which was the obvious choice at the time. It became apparent to me that, you know, the classical music world, the academic new music world, was still in many respects and in many places stuck in this atonal world. They valued, you know, this serialist-esque kind of music that has a lot of dissonance that, you know, to the average listener often sounds like cats running loose on a keyboard, you know? That is not particularly inspiring to me. So I was researching different schools. UT came up. I remember I made a visit, and I quickly heard, you know, through speaking to people, both current and former students as well, that it, their composition program had tolerance for tonality, and it really nurtured, people where they wanted to go.
I love it because it sounds like such a silly idea, this idea that you're like, so I wanted to go to school for music, but this music school was like, listen, we're just interested in random notes being thrown around like you're a bird who's just pressing buttons with their feet. But if you want to go somewhere else where you can like write a song, okay, see you later. But it's true. I mean, like, I understand that from the point of view of like my theater search. Like when I was trying to go looking for colleges, right? I spent some time thinking like, oh, I should probably get a degree in something else. And then everyone, including my parents, were like, just do theater for the love of God.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, I will. But yeah, then theater gets, you know, the arts always have wacky different things going on. And you're like, you know, they do Shakespeare all the time here. Oh, they're only going to do unusual plays where everybody's just wearing all black and they do a lot of mime. And you're like, okay. And then they're like, oh, and this program over here is just going to, all you do is write your own plays. They don't believe in any plays that have already been written. Like, you're like, oh, all right. Every school's got their little, like, you know, thing to sell. Yeah. Like, oh, we're really good at this. So UT, and so I just think it's hilarious that you're like, so UT was into tonal music.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's true. It's true. And it was a good program. And if I'm being completely honest, I also, it was time for me to leave Utah. I think that there was a part of me, you know, after traveling abroad and living abroad so much and having these amazing experiences, experiencing other cultures, I thought I can go back to my own culture, you know, and like experience that in the same way. And then I quickly realized like, no, you can't be objective about those things. This is where you're from. And it was time for me to go. And I was also looking for a place that I might enjoy living. I knew that, I liked warm weather, or at the very least that too much cold weather makes me sad.
Well, we have 6 days a year, so it's lucky that you're here now.
Yes. freak storms notwithstanding.
But even then, when it stops raining, it's somehow still 95 degrees and hot. So, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you mean the snowpocalypse?
I meant the snowpocalypse. Just, yeah.
No, that was just the blip that was 2020 and 2021, right? That's just no.
Yeah. But yeah, warm weather. I knew I wanted, you know, I love riding my bicycle. I was living car free at the time. I lived car free for the better part of a decade. Yeah, it had a music and art scene. So, during the visit, visiting UT and whatnot, and also seeing the city, I fell in love with it. Classic story, artsy fartsy kid comes to visit Austin. They're like, this is the place for me. And the rest is history.
I mean, it's true. Austin, draws the artsy fartsy. It's for sure.
Yeah.
When my mom came to visit me, I had lived here for 1 year. My mom came to visit and we're walking down the street. We're walking down Congress and it starts to rain. And she and I, as you do when rain happens, you're like, what's going on? We didn't have umbrellas with us. We were unprepared. And then these two kids went dancing by us. And they were twirling around and they went, don't you just love the rain? And I was like, Mom, this is what Austin is like.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, it was like, we've got the perfect moment just to show you what this town is like. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. So you got here. Was the program good? Was the college program everything you wanted it to be and more? Or, did you learn more from, existing within the artist community, at large, that's not academic? Because there's a ton.
There is. A lot of things happened all at once.
Sure.
What it feels like to me.
Yeah.
So I did start playing around, musically speaking, when I was here. I remember I was even briefly in a rock band and we played some gigs on Sixth Street very quickly, right? This is a lot of youthful heteronormative activity and energy that is just not for me.
Yeah, we have a lot of that too.
We still have
it. Yeah, is Texas.
We have a lot of that. but there's I met a couple other musicians who shared the same fondness that I did for jazz, but for the particular kind of jazz that's upbeat vocal jazz, from, mid-century, the Ella Fitzgeralds and the Blossom Dearies and Nat King Coles of the world. And we formed a little trio. We had guitar, piano, and a singer. And we would, play around town. We had this amazing, vibe and look. We were all, skinny little vegetarian hipsters all in black, And
what was the name of the band?
Sarah Aranella, as a matter of fact, is just the singer, and we would accompany her. And she's still singing. You can check her out. She's wonderful. It was a good experience for me. I was able to quit my day job. I remember that was a very pivotal moment and decision for me that I was like, I am going to actually be an artist, full time for the first time. It was pretty scary, but it's not easy. During all those years of freelancing, some people are built for it. It's hard. I thought that every month would be the month when I wouldn't make rent and I would end up on the street,
and I
that
do.
month never came. It never came, but my anxious voice in the back of my head never let that up, but I was playing, with these, this jazz trio. You were perfect for cocktail hours, and people loved it. We had that whole vibe. So when I went to UT, I was studying classical composition. You have to take all these credit hours in, playing ensembles. In whatever capacity, if your instrument is piano, I could play with like a chamber ensemble or, with orchestra, or, I could accompany like a choir or something like that. And you also needed to take lessons, you know, private lessons in your instrument. So I, you know, had private composition lessons, and I was also expected to take piano lessons. And I don't know why I had the gumption and just the presumptuousness, but I went to the head of the jazz department and said, you know, I've studied a lot of classical music in my life, and I like jazz a lot, and I'm playing it professionally, and I think I would get a lot more out of just taking jazz piano lessons. Will you teach me and make an exception for me, and we can just make it work with my with my academic plan? And he said yes, and I can't believe that he did. He had no reason to trust me that this would be, you know, that I would actually be a good student. But yeah, bless you, Dr. Helmer. Thank you for taking me on. It was, that to me was an amazing experience of being able to sort of like bridge the divide between the classical music world and jazz. And it is a divide. I mean, like the fifth floor and sixth floor are like in a different world than the rest of it. And, you know, that's an interesting thing that I've noticed about music, even among these incredibly trained academic musicians. You get a jazz musician and a classical musician in the same room, and they can barely speak the same language. It's just such vastly different disciplines.
Yeah.
So to me, I think that that was something that it was a very significant thing that I got out of my college education, was bridging that divide.
It's great that they believed in you in that moment and that they gave you that chance, you know?
Yes.
I know there's a lot of places and people in the world that are definitely not interested in helping, not interested in like, you know, embracing an individual student's journey. But I think, you know, I mean, it's worth it, you know, for so many things. You know, whenever somebody doesn't do that, I'm like, how does this not make you look good if you help them? Like, you know, do you want him to tell stories later about how you two was a jerk to him? No, he will tell everyone, like now on a podcast, how you were helpful and open to him and like were able to give him, you know, an education that really helped him in real life, as opposed to, like you said, with academic, a lot of times they're kind of like just talking to talk, or like, oh, I'm going to write a book about it. Cool. That's great. What about life? I would like to live my life and have this as a job. You know, how can we do that? And also not just be in the symphony. I get that a lot from musician friends where they're like, you know, people are like, oh, a band. Oh, that's not good. Why don't you play in the symphony? And I was like, guys, these are not, you are not comparing apples and oranges. These are like still jobs. It's still a job in the arts. It's okay. Like, how about you let him be in that band so that there's a spot open for you in the symphony? Like, come on, don't force him to go in there.
Well, and you know, to that point, I think the other thing that I got that was very helpful out of this experience, you know, college, the instruction that I got was really great. And, you know, I got the opportunity to write music and have it be performed. You know, and I was writing, you know, new classical music. I wrote a lot of chamber music. I wrote a lot of art songs, you know, which are, oh gosh, there is a long tradition in the classical world of, you know, usually a solo singer with piano accompaniment and like adapting poetry and crafting these songs. They don't, it to the untrained listener, it can sound sort of like light opera, but it's not, it's great. I had a wonderful experience being able to write that music and have it be performed. And, you know, working with mentors, you know, Dr. Grantham and Dr. Charlotte, and they were really wonderful, wonderful teachers for me to learn from. And Dr. Charlotte really, I'm trying to phrase this in the right way. I remember him having a heart-to-heart with me sort of near the end of my schooling and sort of explained to me what a career in academic, you know, new classical music would look like, and sort of leading me through, you know, is this some, you know, submitting to all of these festivals and competitions and like trying to like write for what these, you know, academic musicians are going to look for in a piece of music, you know? And again, a lot of them are still into the plinky plink cats on a piano sort of sound, which is not my oeuvre.
That sounds wild. And, like, yeah, I think that's hilarious and wild that there would be like a, if you're not skilled in this, you can't be a musician. You're like, are you kidding me?
Well, and I mean, you know, I'm being a little hyperbolic there. It's just that.
No,
you know,
I understand. I'm from the theater world. There's a lot where it's like, where they're like, you've got to know how to do these six monologues. And you're like, why? Who cares? Like, doesn't everyone do this same monologue? Like, why does anyone need to do Hamlet anymore? It's okay to do something different, right?
Yeah.
And like, it's like, you have, in my mind, when you're creating a musical education scenario, it's like, what can I teach you that will cover the breadth of what you might encounter, right?
Yeah.
I feel like academic is so limiting a lot of times, you know, like even in theater, they teach you about plays and about how to be in one, but they never tell you like, hey, this is how the business of a theater runs. This is how you get a job in it. These are the various jobs you might have to work to get to where you're trying to do. And with you, they're like, listen, can you compose this unusual? They're like, I'm composing every day for you. I'm doing this outside of school professionally, I feel like I'm winning and you're looking at me like I'm not. So what is it that you people want? Like,
yeah, well, and you know, and I want to be clear. I don't think that, you know, the teachers that I was working with at UT were those people. I think that they were wonderful and supportive. And that's why, you know, having this conversation, you know, was so pivotal for me to, where he helped me realize like this world, you know, this experience that you've had with us at UT is not necessarily the way the rest of the world works. This is how the rest of, you know, academic music sort of operates. And, you know, and do you think that that's where you want to be? And it was very clear that like, that was not what I was interested in, you know?
Yeah.
And it was, I appreciate that, you know, that he didn't try to funnel me towards grad school, because that would have been a really, I don't think it would have been a good experience for me. And I'm really grateful that I didn't do that. And that I, you know, had the career that I had.
Yeah.
That I have had in Austin.
Yeah. So how did you, so you get through UT, you've made your way through this program, you're doing what they tell you to do, even though, like you say, your advisor is like, hey, bud, like, you're doing great, you're killing it, but maybe this crowd, not your crowd. Like, so how do you find your crowd? Like, now you have all sorts of different performances that you're doing that are not either a jazz band or a symphony.
Yes.
How did you find the new world?
Well, that is a good question. While all of this was happening, you know, I was playing this little jazz ensemble. I answered a Craigslist ad that needed a pianist for an improv gig, essentially. And, you know, to make it brief, I was very quickly introduced to this whole world of people, you know, doing improv theater. And, you know, like I mentioned before, since I was a kid, I've always had this skill of having a good ear. You know, I can like hear music and play it. And it's always been sort of like a fun party trick, you know, it's just like, hey, Ammon, can you play this song and like play it for me? And then I'm like, I can play it, you know? and all of a sudden I feel like I was just thrown into this expansive community of people who were like, oh my God, that is a marketable skill. I was like, really? And they were like, You're going to do so with us every weekend from now on.
You are ours now. Thank you for joining us.
It was, you know, a wonderful experience. I'm sure Austin is a mecca for improv, and it's full of amazing people. I've performed in every theater, improv theater, in probably almost every theater in Austin at this point. It was a lot of fun. It honed and sharpened the skills that I already have, and it was delightful. I don't feel like I'm a performer myself in a theatrical sense, but I feel safe when I'm behind a keyboard and on stage, it's rewarding. I'm not, I don't consider myself a funny person, but I understand comedic timing. And, it's really satisfying to, to get those laughs and those reactions just from music, and it can feel like shooting fish in a barrel, where it's like, let's open on, a beach. And I start playing The Little Mermaid and people laugh, it's just, or like a bar and Cheers theme or whatever. And I think that there's something about it that hearing instrumental music, there's a little second longer to process it. Or when people do process it, it activates a different part of their brain. And it's funny, but it also, I feel like it makes the listener feel smart, maybe, or just it satisfies in a different way, because mm-hmm. they're like, I got that. They opened on like a 1920s library and he's playing some like old timey ragtime music, but it's also the Reading Rainbow theme song. It's like things like that, where it was fun for me to do this. Like I have these abilities, I could use them. And it was just delightful to get those reactions, and the people I was playing with just loved it, and to have them take it, take those offers and run with them. It was an amazing experience. So all of this, when I said that all this was happening at the same time, I feel like it was just a big jumble of all of these things, I also got involved with, the Story Wranglers program at the Paramount Theater, which is an amazing program. They teach creative writing workshops in school, in classrooms, to third graders in schools throughout the Austin area. So these kids hone their literacy skills. They feel super confident writing these stories by the end of the residency. And then they gather the stories that these kids have written, hire adult actors to read through them, devise a show that is then performed in front of their entire school. So these third graders go through this process of, learning to write these stories, and then eventually get those stories performed and shared in front of their whole school so that they can, stand up and take credit for their work. And it's an incredible program. Not dissimilar to Story Pirates or formerly Barrel of Monkeys. And that was another example where, I had this skill set that was just eaten up. I mean, for, underscoring sketches is one thing. I can obviously do that. I can play whatever musical themes is necessary for, whatever, third grade fever dream is being presented on stage. but we would also usually adapt half of the stories into songs. And I can write songs, it's a 24-hour turnaround. I can do that. I've been writing music since I was a little kid.
You're officially UT trained to compose music. You're officially like legit UT
trained to compose. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I have, the fluency to play in, pretty much any genre. So it quickly became, one of the staples of my, my gigging, life, my freelancing life. Sorry, I'm trying to find the word freelancing. And, you know, through that, I also became involved in other education projects. I worked with Zach Theater. They have, you know, a pre-professional company. I would, you know, train these kids who were just incredible, incredible performers. So I was working in, there was a hot minute where I felt like I was working everywhere. I was just in every theater in Austin, doing everything that I could. And when I graduated from UT, I took on a position at McCallum, Fine Arts Academy, a fine arts high school here in Austin. I was the assistant choir director / musical theater teacher. And it was an incredible school. Again, because, you know, it was a fine arts academy. They had a student body that was really dedicated and passionate about the arts. But it was also a local high school. And I loved that model. I loved having, you know, choir classes full of some kids who had studied extensively, you know, had vocal training for years, and other kids who needed to take a fine arts credit and didn't want to do art, you know, and we were all on this together and making, you know, the best choir that we possibly could. It was a really great experience. It was an amazing school. It was incredibly, incredibly demanding. And, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, careers and, you know, schooling in the arts is incredibly time consuming. Rehearsals take up a lot of time. Yeah. And, you know, there were just so many kids that needed help. And once people understood that I was a very solid accompanist, and I am, I love accompanying singers. I feel like I was just constantly in demand, and, you know, and I wanted to help, and it was wonderful to be able to help. But it, you know, it was very time consuming, very exhausting. You know, I remember one of the two assistant band directors chatting with me one day, and he said, you know, I do more work as the assistant band director at the school than I ever did when I was, you know, chairing the entire department at another school. It's just, it's so much. And I also, while I was gone from the Paramount, they sort of realized that they missed me, I think. you know, approached me with an offer to create a full-time position for me. Awesome. And so it was hard. It was a really hard decision, but ultimately I asked myself what my life would look like if, you know, if I stayed teaching, you know, in this very rewarding but very rigorous school. And ultimately, I do want to write. I want to compose. And I think that if I stayed there, it would have been really hard for me to find time and space to write anything, you know. And I took the position at the Paramount. I've been there ever since. I'm their resident music director for education. And it's great. You know, a lot of my time is music directing the Story Wranglers Ensemble, you know, with the process that I described. You know, I also teach in the classroom, you know, the writing portion of the program. We also have summer camps, and I music direct all of their summer camps. We make a big musical review. And I select all of the music and, you know, create mashups that are based around a theme, you know, whether it's, the four elements, you know, songs about water and earth and fire, whatever, or, you know, the 80s or, you know, Hello and Goodbye or whatever. And it's delightful for me that I can create these insane, you know, mashups and medleys of all of these different, you know, songs from, you know, modern culture. And it's sort of like a crash course in education for the kids, you know, who were participating, where, you know, they'll sing everything from Gloria Estefan to Sondheim to, you know,
Barney.
To Barney?
Yeah. I don't know. I love you, whatever. You love me. Or, you know, they're little kids. Yeah. Maybe they're listening to it. My kid listens to Storybots and sings that all day. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, educational children's music is has a breadth I was unaware of until I had a child.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. So, what an amazing piece. Understanding of yourself and what you needed, and also like good on you for your self-care that you were like, okay, there are these two jobs in front of me. Both are great, but this one's going to give me the time and space to be both working as an artist and an artist on my own. Whereas the other one was just like too much all the time. So intense.
Yeah.
If the musical director that's currently working there is listening, like, we support you. You're doing great. Keep going.
Oh, he is. And I know him and he's wonderful.
Oh, good. Yeah. Because I was like, it sounds like a hard job. So whoever took it over from you, like, you're doing it, buddy. You're great. You just want to send support to that guy. But the other thing I wanted to say is, yeah, love you, Tyler. But the other thing I wanted to say was, like, how amazing. I feel like it's such a validating moment for a theater that's as important to this town as the Paramount to come to you and say, hey, we want you. We want to create a job so that you're with us all the time. That's super validating. That's super like heartwarming. And, you know, I don't know how it felt to you or it feels to you now, but like, it's impressive. It speaks to the hard work you've put in since the Beethoven tapes all the way through, you know, and figuring out, you know, what you like best about teaching and the little bits from improv that have helped you to, you know, create these medleys and whatnot. Like that, you were able to not just find, but create a position at one of the more, like I said, one of the more formative theaters in this town to have a job and to be teaching and composing music. And that's awesome. That's so awesome. Good on you.
Thank you. Yeah, it is. I'm incredibly grateful to be in the position that I am every day, you know, and it does feel very unique, the job that I have. I can't think of an analogous position anywhere else, really, you know, and it's incredibly rewarding. And, you know, I love that I'm able to create, that I'm expected to create in my job, you know, that I'm not just, you know, teaching, you know, from the score, you know, and trying to like get our sound to match it. Not that I'm disparaging that work at all. It's incredible and important work, but I love that, you know, I get to take stories that third graders have written and, you know, about dragon princesses and turn them into amazing disco numbers that, you know, are performed by these incredible performers that we have. So thank you for that. I mean, it's good to step back and recognize, you know, where I've come from and what I've accomplished. And it is a lot, and it's not lost on me. I'm incredibly grateful for it.
I mean, it really just feels like whoever invented that job for you, like, really saw all of your talents and was like, what can we do to put them all into one job? Because this guy's great and I want all of his greatness to be hanging out with me only. And so, Plus, share with the third graders, get them in early, mm-hmm. you know, get them where they're really creative. By the time you're in high school, you're probably anxious about stuff. And there's all sorts of different things. And like you mentioned, you're teaching classes where it's like half wants to be there, half is there because they have to. Yeah. That's like all the summer camps I teach, by the way.
Yeah.
The first question I ask at the beginning of every summer camp is, who signed up for this because they wanted to be here? I write down the names. Who signed up because your parents made you come? All right, good. Awesome. And I try to give them different experiences because, like, they don't want, like, the people who don't want to be there, you know, they don't want to be the lead, right? They don't care. So I'm like, great, you're not the lead. And that's cool. But we have some really solid side stuff that we need your help with. If you could help us with that to make these guys who want to shine, shine, that'd be great. You know, and then they get a little taste of, you know, the world of helping, of being there for other people, which is also something that I think you're doing really well as well. I like the fact that you're creating your own music and you're, you know, working on your art, but you're also supporting so many other people. Like, you're helping these performers, you're helping these kids, you're helping the education department of the theater. Like, you're whole work is not just music, but it's also like community building and like just general educational assistance for people. Like, that's a great example to kids and to performers for, like, this is an important part of the work.
Yeah. And, you know, to bring it back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, realizations that a huge part of me will always be connected to, you know, my Mormon upbringing. It's still there. I feel like I have this responsibility to, you know, organize the things to make people better and, you know, like education and all of these things. It's still a part of me, you know? So yeah, I'm very grateful that I can use my art and my talent to make a positive difference in the world.
Of all the things I've heard about Mormonism, the idea that you wanting to help and educate people and organize stuff sounds like a lovely part. I mean, I don't know much about it, but I'm not watching the documentaries that are about the singing and the organizing. So it sounds nice. It sounds like some solid skills to have pulled out from the whole experience.
But yes, for sure. There are some great documentaries out there. They focus on other things.
Sure, sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, I often think to myself when I watch these things, like, but would they have made this if it wasn't shocking? You know, like, nobody makes a documentary where they're like, and then they were all very happy. And you're like, oh, all right. Well, I was like, what was that, 20 minutes? Okay. That was a good documentary, I guess. It's true. I mean, nobody's ever telling a story about, like, how things totally worked out. Yeah. That's... Man, whenever I'm teaching writing classes and people are like, but another thing went wrong. I was like, everything goes wrong. You're writing a story that people are listening to. Real life might work out occasionally, but stories never will. She's going to fail. Let her fail.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So are you still right now during the past couple of years, like, are you still working with the Paramount? Like, how did the form of what you're doing change? I saw very recently there was a call for new performers for Story Wranglers. Yes. So yay, that means that probably they're going back.
We are going to, we're going to have live shows again.
Great.
And we just had a company meeting with new ensemble members 2 nights ago. It went very well. I'm super excited about it. During the pandemic, we did transition to teaching the writing courses online over Zoom. Everyone's doing Zoom school. Mm-hmm. And we, I hate the word pivot, but we transitioned into creating digital content. So essentially we were making YouTube videos of the kids' stories. So it was, the process was, you know, other than the digital platform being different, individual artists would take a story and develop that on their own, as opposed to, you know, more of an ensemble building activity. So I'm glad that we were able to do that. It was hard for me. You know, I'm a live acoustic musician. I'm a I'm a believer in, like, let's just do it live. Let's make it make it happen that way. I've never been good at audio engineering. You know, you obviously are. I see all of the equipment behind you, and how, you know, it's hard for me. It's a struggle for me to, you know, I can do it. I've built up those skills, but it doesn't come as easily as making things sound good in a live room, working with what you have to make that good. So I'm very eager to go back to that. Very eager.
Oh, absolutely. I prefer live theater as well. For many years, I was like, oh, maybe, you know, I could get more into film or doing these other things. I taught a lot of Zoom classes over the past couple years, but it's like, yeah, I really want to be in person with some people. Like, yeah. I would like to talk to them and have them react in whatever way that they're going to, and me deal with that. Like, I want to see their little faces. And, you know, teaching little third graders how to write funny stories that then get to be performed sounds like the most fun.
It is incredibly fun.
Yeah. Well, that's so super great. I have, you know, one more question for you, and it's surprising because I told you I was going to ask you some questions, but I have a different one. Ooh, inspired by you. is that, you know, you have been so in the story as you're telling it, you know, you've been dedicated to this life as a musician. At any point did you consider quitting? Like, you seem so, you know, it doesn't seem in your storytelling as if there was ever a moment where you're like, forget it, I'm not going to be a musician anymore. Like, is it just so deeply in your blood and your bones that you're like, I am a musician first and then like a person second? Like, how did you keep it going? Because there's a lot of ups and downs in your story. There could be a lot of times where you're like, and then, you know, for 6 years, I worked as a sales guy for Progressive or whatever, you know, like before you realize, how did you keep it going?
Oh, that's a good question. I feel like I have a relationship with music, you know, and piano, and all of those things, that is, it feels like a separate entity from me, that it's a lifelong partner, and, you know, that I need to maintain a relationship with. And, you know, there are some times when that relationship has become fraught. There have been some times, when I'm not certain that it's what I want to do. There's definitely some times when, at the very least, I'm not certain that I want to pursue it professionally. You know, it's a lot sometimes to, you know, have your passion and day job be the same thing. and there have been, you know, some beautiful times in my life. You know, when I was working at Kinko's, and I would come home at night and I would clock out, the day would be done, and I could play whatever I wanted to on my piano, and it felt open and freeing. You know, there have been some times when I have incredible opportunities and I feel grateful for them, and I'm, you know, creating this amazing art, and there's going to be a full audience there to listen to it. And the pressure just feels, you know, overwhelming. And, you know, there are a lot of times where I'll want to practice my piano and I look at it and it, you know, the passion that I felt years ago is wearing thin, and it feels, and it hurts. It hurts the way I think a relationship would. So to answer your question, yes, I feel like music has always been a part of my life. I feel like it's a relationship that I need to maintain to be healthy. And, you know, I've never actually thought of it that way until just now. So real glad we got it down. I can take that and like straight to therapy and unpack all of that. But
you're welcome, doctor.
But yeah, I think that would be the way that I would describe it.
Yeah. Absolutely. The reason why I ask is that I'm listening to your story and it sounds so deeply triumphant, so many different great opportunities and stuff. But for me, you know, there's an up and down. Will I always forevermore be involved in arts and creating things? Yeah, I'll never stop. It'll always be what I'm doing. Even if I'm not paid for it, it's always, you know, I got little notebooks. I got 1,000 things. Oh, she's so many notebooks, but sometimes, you know, you just hit the wall and you're like, nobody, this is not what I want. Or I wish that there was some, you know, the grass is always greener. You're like, man, my friends that are doing XYZ seem to be happier, you know? And so you figure out, how do I maintain that? How do I keep it going? And certainly in the last 2 years, there's been a lot of opportunity to be like, yeah, maybe you should make another decision, because it looks like this career path doesn't exist anymore. So what are you going to do? What other skills do you have? You know, and to having that time to think about it and to really get to decide, you know, like when you're given the opportunity to really think, do I want to keep doing this? Is this really, really what I want? When you hear that voice in your head that says, yeah, absolutely. Even when it's hard, I want to do it. Mm-hmm. Even when I'm like, I'm so stressed out, I keep wanting to do it, right? And I have to remind myself of that in those moments. There have been times when I've been so stressed out because of a show that's coming up, and I'm all like, what am I going to do? This is so crazy. And then the tiny voice in the back is like, you love this. Everything you're doing is exactly what you want to do. And I'm like, oh, right. Yes. Okay. So let's keep going, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it's just... I feel, as you telling me your story, like I feel the love from you. Like I feel it's clearly who you are, and like so your complete being, this like as a musician. I love the fact that you wanted to compose. You did it. You've then found a way to literally make your life all about composing constantly, mixing and matching and creating and being on the fly and like living a life. It's as close to a jazz musician as you could possibly be, to be doing improv and creating shows with these people and those people and you know, teaching and entertaining all at once. So it's really amazing. You have a great story.
Thank you,
Ammon, for being on the podcast. You've given us a great story and a wonderful path that hopefully the listeners of the podcast can be inspired by and know that, you know, whatever artistic path they've got in front of them, you know, they can do it. Just keep working on it. Yeah. Find your own people. They're out there. You know, maybe they're not the people you're currently with, but keep looking for them, because there's different communities and maybe your people are just a Craigslist ad away. Don't go on Craigslist right now. And it's 2021. Do not go on Craigslist right now. But in the early 2000s, Craigslist was the place, right?
Yes, it was.
So thank you for being on the podcast. I really appreciate you.
Absolutely. Do I have time to plug one thing that I would love to
plug?
Plug it all.
Plug everything, sure.
I wrote a song cycle that explores our dystopian future in a world altered by climate change. Mm. I put a lot of work into it, and it's a very... It's an amazing piece of music and theater. And it's called Rites of Warming, R-I-T-E-S. And you can check it out at ritesofwarming.com.
And the whole piece is available there, like in a YouTube clip or video?
It lives on YouTube. I don't have the entire clip posted publicly. You can DM me and I'll send it to you.
Okay. So, but like the people that are listening, if they go to the website and they're like super into it, they can connect with you to like watch it or, you know, buy it from you and or whatever.
I have clips, available. There's lots of things that are constantly happening. I just did, a show with some climate activists in the UK. Showed the show at the Rogue Theater Festival earlier. I have several irons in the fire right now. Nothing that I can officially say at this moment, but, there are good things happening with the show. But I would love for people to be aware of it, take a look at it. If you want to talk with me more about it, it's an incredible show. It's grounded in climate science. I had the opportunity to collaborate with a scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. And it's a really impactful piece that I'm very proud of.
Wow. Educating on all levels. I really love it. Yeah. No, it's like your work life is doing music education. And then you're like, let me just do this on my own composition where I'm going to educate you about climate change. I love it. I love it. It even harkens back to what you were saying earlier about people's connection with music. Like people are able to receive information in music so differently than they are to get words. You know, you can tell people all day, hey, don't do this, it affects the climate. And they're like, yeah, all right, sure. But if you like write a good like song and you've got actors really showing the deep emotion, you're like, guys, did you know that climate change is a problem? And they're like, yeah, that's what we wrote this whole musical about. Thanks, though.
No, I definitely learned that, people have very strong reactions to this. I hoped that people would, react in some way, and I did not expect the way they do. And a lot of it, I have learned that we're aware of this and that we sort of like bottle it in our subconscious because we don't feel like there's a lot we can do about it. We feel powerless. And when people, see and hear it presented artistically, all of these subconscious emotions and conflict just come right up to the surface. And, after each show, when we put it up in 2019, right before the pandemic, I would have a talk back each night with a climate scientist and, Josh Willis, he's great. And people's reactions made me realize that they were reacting to the show, but it was about so much more than the show, that they were like carrying these things with them, these worries that usually come up at, 3 in the morning, are coming up, through this piece of art. So, I didn't originally have a plan that, this is how I'm going to change the world or help people through this thing. I was just like, I have a question about, the science, and I want to explore it artistically. And since then I've realized that it serves a role because it's hard for us as humans to tackle a problem until we've emotionally dealt with, the full depth and ramifications of that problem. So
what a great lesson as an artist for yourself, to get that, because I think that, you're like, I didn't know how it was going to work. I don't think any artist can create with the end game in mind. It's impossible. You know what I mean? Like, and in fact, you can see like movies, for instance, you can see a movie that was created from the end game idea. Like it doesn't work as well because it doesn't have that visceral connection. Now, music, like you say, totally cuts straight to the heart faster than any play, words, movement, doesn't matter. The music does it. It like gets us in a way that's like different and special. And so you can use it as an educational tool, but it's probably better that you went into it with your interest, with your excitement. Mm-hmm. Because if you were like, I'm going to teach the world about climate change, it'd be
Yeah, it isn't, didactic in that sense at all. We're just exploring you know, taking scientific projections, you know, of like, if we keep on the current path at the end of the century, bad things are going to happen. And it was always sort of like vague. And I really wanted to like explore, you know, in a more clear and defined way, like, what are the things that we can expect from, you know, like wildfires and hurricanes to sea level rise and, you know, refugees. So yeah, it was each song. It was also, it interpolates parts of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, and it's also inspired by jazz standards. So I feel like, you know, I've constantly had this identity crisis of like, am I a classical musician? Am I a jazz musician? But I'm working musical theater. So it was a great way to combine all of that, all those musical disparate, you know, threads into one piece. And yeah, I'll say the only, to your point of, you know, the end game in sight, the only thing I tried to do was, I studied, you know, Kurt Vonnegut's, story arcs, and I'm like, this needs to have, I'm familiar with song cycles, again, you know, long classical tradition. and I knew that it needed to have, if not a specific narrative, it needed to have an arc that worked well. And so, you know, I looked at, you know, Kurt Vonnegut's, you know, there's like the Cinderella archetype. I'm not using the right word, but you know, he mapped out how like all stories tend to follow like similar arcs. And I was like, what is this going to follow? This show that I'm writing about climate change. And the one model that it followed was called From Bad to Worse, where things just take a nosedive and keep going. And I was like, how, like, what are examples of this? And it's like Great Expectations or the Book of Job or Awful Tragedies, you know? And I'm like, oh my God, like, how is this going to be engaging? And, you know, I had a great conversation with someone at a conference who was doing a presentation about this. And I'm like, dude, tell me, where's the pleasure in the audience of stories that follow this, you know, this form? And, you know, he explained, like, even though you know things are going to end badly, there's this sort of, like, macabre fascination. Like, you want to know, like, exactly how badly it will end, you know?
Yeah.
And it, you know, yeah, there's some funny songs in there, you know? I front-loaded all the comedy at the beginning, and then at the end, you
it's
know?
It's terrible. Gets it's, bad.
It gets bad, but
it's not pleasant.
Mm-mm. It's not pleasant, but it's... it's important. It's important to, I think, to meet it face to face and head on, you know,
yeah.
That, you know, to listen to a song where, you know, Miami's underwater and someone's just talking about the memories that they have and how they feel about that, you know. It's a lot. People feel a lot and they cry, but, you know, it's important to explore those emotions so that when opportunities to, you know, contact your representatives come up, you know, that you're speaking from a place of passion and conviction, you know, it's an important thing. And art has an important role to play in that.
Yeah. I mean, either that or like just move towards the center of the country. That seems to get sort of more, I feel like Kansas and Oklahoma could get some more population, guys. Like, get in there. Because you don't stay in Florida. It's not.
Yeah. It's.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny you're talking about this storytelling structure and how you're like, oh man, I can't believe things are terrible. I was like, the number one play that they do in high schools is Romeo and Juliet. It's the saddest thing. It's like, hey, kids, did you want a date? Don't let it go this bad. It's like, whoa. Like, nobody's happy at the end. No one's like, you know what, though? But Romeo and Juliet, better that they're gone, you know? Because. Yeah. You know, it's like, what? No. I was like, you know, thinking about, I was like, also, P.S., like, the number one podcast is true crime. People love it when it's terrible.
True.
Like,
it's true.
That's what they're looking for. I mean, I just saw somebody post the other day where they were like, why do all these stories have to end so badly? I was like, that's what you want. They don't want to end them. We're the artists. We'd love a happy ending, but we can't because that's not what we're going to sell. Yeah. These people probably tried to write a pleasant story and they were like, okay, I see where you're going, where they fall in love at the end, but what if the whole world goes into a black hole? And they're like, what? They're like, that's how we're going to end it. Good, good, good guys, good guys. Like, yeah, I mean, classic for sure.
It happens in third graders as well when I'm writing stories with them. I'm like, are we on the same page that you really want to write a story where the entire world turns to stone? And they're like, yes.
I'm oh, like, yeah, okay. They're the roughest. Like, children writing are really intense. Like, I do comedy camps. Comedy. We're writing jokes, okay? I do comedy camps for junior high and high school. By the time they're in high school, they're already sort of adultish in their brain enough that they want to fluff things and make things happy ending-ish. So I get a lot of that from them. But the junior high kids, they are dark. They're like, what if at the end of this scene about a pilot, the plane crashes? I'm like, okay, all right. Sure. Where's the funny? Tell me how that's funny. I will let you crash this plane if you tell me why it's funny. Like, you know, because later your parents are going to ask me and I need to have a good reason. All right. So,
yeah,
my favorite parts of those, and I'm sure you guys do it too when you do the presentations, is to be like, hey, parents, just so you know, your kids wrote this. I didn't write this. This was not my idea. When you see the sixth sketch, you're going to be like, what is going on? That was your kid. That was not me. I just was like, oh, yeah, next. All right. So then the goat does what? Great. Sure. All right. Like, hey. Oh, it's man. True. So funny. Yeah. I mean, hey, you know, some stories don't end well. I would say life in general. Yeah. So like, you know, if that's the way you have to tell a story to get the point across, then that's the way you got to tell a story. You know, I love all the research that you did for it, too. Talking to the NASA scientist, like, chef's kiss. Amazing. Like, oh, God, so much like research and work that you put into this awesome project. Yeah, and you're like researching story structure from Kurt Vonnegut. What? Oh, God, this is just fun to talk about this one little project that you worked on. Gosh, you put so much good work into it.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a lot, but it was, you know, it was also for myself. I'm curious about it. I want to know. And, you know, there's resources out there. People have made, you know, you want to know what the world looks like with 2 meters of sea level rise. This is what it's going to look like. It's not a very fun picture, but it's, you can tell, you know, and I think it's important to, again, to get that out there, that people understand the ramifications of what we're up against.
I love it. I love the work that you're doing. I love all of the educational stuff, both for adults and for children. You've found a way to, you know, use your art in such a great way. I feel like that's it's sort of like a transition of adulthood, you know. At first, it's all about like me, check me out. Did you know that I could play this piano? And then it's like, how can I change the world a little bit? And you're really doing it. You're like in a great spot to be changing the world for, you know, the next few years until eventually, you know, whatever next adventure leads you to use your musical ability to work on that. Like, who knows? But right now, like, such good work. And I appreciate you for being in the world and super close to me. Yes. Even though we're on Zoom, like, where we could be next door to each other. Like, we don't know. Awesome. So, Ammon, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You've given me such great information, and I look forward to sharing all of this with the audience.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.